messianic psalm, we found that our Lord taught the disciples after his resurrection from the Psalms all things pertaining to himself. In other words, he definitely used messianic psalms. He also used messianic psalms to prove his deity and establish his eternality. We found that both Paul and Peter used the messianic psalm that predicted the resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, tonight we're on a suffering psalm. It's going to deal almost in its entirety with the suffering of Messiah. And this psalm has a natural division at the 21st verse, so that the first 21 verses, Psalm 22, verses 1 through 22, we have Messiah's suffering expressed. There are 31 verses in this psalm, and you know, in my speed, I can usually cover at least two verses in a service. So in order to do this whole thing tonight, we are going to have to move. The emphasis of these sufferings that Messiah expresses has to do with alienation, hyphen, prayer. In the alienation that our Lord feels at Calvary, there is a feeling of despair and a forsakenness that prompts him to pray, so that you have a pattern, okay? A pattern runs something like this. The pattern in the psalm will be, first of all, a question, and in the question there is a certain amount of agony. And then that is always followed by a trust expression with a prayer request, something spoken. These run like this. We have question agony in verses 1 and 2, and then trust prayer in verses 3 and 5. We have question agony in verses 6 through 8, followed by trust prayer in verses 9 through 11. Question agony in verse 12 through 18, followed by trust prayer in 19 through 21. This is the pattern, and you will see it, and in my outline and in the notes that you're taking notes, we'll try to stipulate that. First, verses 1 through 5, letter A under capital letter 1, forsaken by God. Forsaken by God. Messiah is going to express his agony in verses 1 and 2. We have, first of all, question, agony, verse 1 and 2. Let's read it. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me? And the word helping there means delivering me, saving me. Why art thou so far from the words of my roaring? And the word roaring there is, carries with it the connotation of groaning, of deep, severe agony. Now all of you recognize that as the word spoken on the cross by our Lord Jesus Christ. Okay? They are recorded in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 46. Somebody has collected the sayings of Christ on the cross, the seven sayings. These would be the fourth, if you were thinking that. But the point of the passage, of course, is the desertion that Messiah felt as the sins of the world were placed upon him by God. And it's very exciting that the psalm begins with the deepest, most intense desertion that Messiah feels, the deepest agony that he feels. This is the agony of separation from God. Well, we could put in our notes the idea as the sins of the world, as the sins of the world are laid upon Messiah. Now that is absolutely incomprehensible to us. In other words, we cannot comprehend the severity of that agony. If you have intensely loved somebody, where your identity is so close, and your the warmth and the presence that you have with this person is so close, and you are suddenly torn apart and taken apart, you know that there is a pain that you feel. You feel physical pain. You feel mental pain. You may even feel an ache in your chest. We know a little bit of that kind of an agony. But it is impossible for us to know the tremendous depth of despair and anxiety or agony that our Lord felt when he was separated from God the Father. And the psalm begins with that expression, totally divorced from the fellowship that he had with God the Father from eternity past. The sins of the world were laid upon Messiah. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, he, God, hath made him, Christ, to be sin for us, he who knew no sin. Okay? So he is forsaken, and he feels it, and he gives expression of it. Look at verse 2. Oh, my God, I cry in the daytime, but thou hearest not, and in the night season, and I am not silent, which means that Messiah had no rest. He had no calm about this matter. He was deeply disturbed. And he was giving expression of that continually. Okay? Okay. But he remained forsaken. Now, as the pattern of the psalm begins to unfold, following the question agony, you have the trust prayer. Okay? And this is expressed in verse... I'm breaking pencils and phrases. Verse 3 through 5. And I want you to notice that he is anchored, Messiah is anchored in two things. And these are two things that every believer needs to anchor himself in. By the way, the only way to understand this type of expression relative to Jesus Christ, who was both God and man, is that this is an expression of his humanity. The humanity of Jesus, or the humanity of Christ, the Messiah. There are statements in the New Testament that Jesus makes that are absolutely incomprehensible apart from seeing him as either God or man. No man taketh my life from me. I both lay it down and I will take it up again. Humanity or deity? Deity. Only deity could make that kind of statement. I thirst. Humanity or deity? Humanity, of course. There are statements in the New Testament that are totally incomprehensible apart from the deity and humanity of Jesus Christ. This is our Messiah speaking out of his humanity in the entire psalm, or at least this entire first part of the psalm. Okay, now following that agony is the fact that he is anchored in two things. He is anchored in the essence of God, and he is anchored in the act of God. All right? Watch the trust prayer in verse 3. But thou art holy, O thou that inhabitest the praises of Israel. Would somebody read the New American of that verse, please? Verse 3. Anybody, read it loudly. Not everybody at once, please. Yeah, the word inhabited is the idea that God is in a unique position, enthroned, exalted, on the praises of those who really know him. In other words, God is not acting outside his character. Verse 3 says, coming from the lips of Messiah, thou art holy. Now, the holiness of God comprises two major aspects of his essence. What are they? Okay, holiness of God. In fact, the word holy means that God is totally separate. He's unique. The word in itself.
He's set apart.
He's set apart totally from any concept of personal sin.
And involved are two things, his righteousness and his justice. Righteousness involves a standard. And because he is the creator, he has the right to impose his standards upon his creation. It means he has some things that he thinks are right and wrong.
And so he out of his essence, out of his holiness, comes these standards for mankind.
I'm tempted to chase a rabbit. I'll resist.
Justice means he is fair in application of the standards. He's fair to the whole human race. He judges in his justice, but he is totally fair. Now, Messiah, who is sinless. One of the beautiful things about this psalm is there's no confession of sin in this psalm. This is a lament psalm. And somewhere in the experience of David, he experienced to a degree some of these things. Some of these things he could not have experienced. We'll see that later. But in that experience, he expresses the fact that his reliance is on the fact that God is totally righteous and totally just. He is anchored in that. And that's what we have to do. We have to be anchored in the essence of God. Then he says, our fathers trusted. The word is batak, which means normally in Hebrew to hope, relative to the present or to the future. Our fathers hoped or trusted in thee. They trusted, and thou didst deliver them. They cried unto you, and were delivered. They trusted in you, and were not confounded or disappointed, meaning that trust placed in God, the God of the Israelites, was never misplaced trust. They never got confused or let down in their trust.
Now, what is he referring to? He is referring to, in verse 4 and 5, the historical acts of God relative to Israel.
So Messiah is saying, thou art totally trustworthy. You delivered the patriarch. And trust and rescue are related like cause and effect. Get the idea? Here we have trust directed toward Yahweh, Jehovah, and that resulted in rescue. Now that would be equated to cause equals effect. So that in the midst of Messiah's deepest spiritual battle, he expresses his confidence in the absolute holiness of God and the fact that God never fails those who put their trust in him in the past. Beautiful parallelism now that is going to run all the way through the psalm. We could say the same thing about us in terms of any type of suffering. Suffering is something that blows the mind of the human race. It blows the mind of the unbeliever. We'll see that in a few minutes. They cannot interpret being in the will of God and suffering. It just blows their mind. And sometimes that happens to Christians. They get blown away by the fact that they experience suffering. And they begin to question whether they're in the will of God. Here is Messiah right in the midst of the will of God, and he is forsaken, and he suffers, and yet he expresses his confidence in Jehovah. Now in verse 6 through 11, the focus now shifts
to mankind. He is forsaken by mankind. Okay? And we begin again. We have question, agony, parallelism, verse 6 through 8. But I am a worm. He begins by focusing on his own mentality under these conditions. His image of himself now is completely destroyed. He is suffering excruciating degradation and alienation from all members of mankind, including his disciples. They are fleeing from him at the cross. And he says, I am a worm. Okay? Now, what does that mean? You notice you have to supply the verb. That means that this object is, or the statement is intensified in its significance to the person who uttered it. The fact of the statement is outstanding. The imagery of a worm, maybe you've heard people talk about the word that he used for worm is the word tola. And tola was not any worm, it was a worm from which they got scarlet dye. And so a lot of people say he uses the imagery because he's going to pour out his blood in this condition. I think that's stretching this thing a little bit too far myself. He's not so concerned that this type of worm is due to a red dye. The concept is that a worm is helpless, see? It is helpless. It is stepped upon. It is underfoot. It is defenseless as far as human beings are concerned. It is defenseless. See, the imagery, it is lowly. The imagery is around that aspect of the worm. Now, this is a Hebrew introductory statement, which is very common in Hebrew. This is the introductory fact. Okay? And you will find allusions to all kind of animals that are going to proceed out of this in terms of human beings. This is how he sees himself. Okay? The introductory fact will be developed. What he means by this will be developed in the next few lines. Okay? In verses 6b, I am a worm and no man. As far as being able to stand up to men and fight back, he can't do it. He's under the will of the Father. He knows that. He has to subjugate himself to that. And all of this degradation and alienation has got to him. I am a reproach of men. Okay, so in verses 6 forward, we have the development that looks like this. I am a worm and no man. We should include that up here. Okay, now, what does that mean? He is reproached. See? By men. And he's not going to answer them back. I am despised of the people. So he is despised or he is hated. It isn't that he's just reproached and scoffed, but he's actually hated. Then in verse 7, all they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip, or they curl their lips. They sort of snarl at him. They shake their head, or they wag their head, mocking him. So the picture is one of mockery. He is mocked. He is sneered at. Picture is sneering, leering, ridicule, you see. And with all kind of facial expression, mimic. Okay? Now here is one of the ways that they do that. Verse 8. He trusted on the Lord. Now that's an interesting expression in Hebrew. This mockery finds its expression in verse 8. The expression would literally read, not that he, it's an infinitive, first of all, for those of you who study Hebrew. So the translators interpret whether the infinitive should be an indicative statement. King James opts for that. They say he trusted on the Lord. But really, what it should be is, let him do this. Okay? Like a subjunctive expression. Let him, permit him. Let him roll upon Yahweh. Let him roll upon Jehovah. He will deliver him. Let him deliver him, seeing he delighted in him. And the idea is that his trust, Messiah's trust, in Jehovah is mocked. Okay. Would you look in conjunction with... Oh, by the way, let me point out this word trust. King James translates this trust. This is the Hebrew word galal. Galal